Good morning. My name's Nora Peel. I'm the Deputy Director of the Boston Book Festival. Thank you so much for joining us here today. I'd especially like to thank Renee Combs and the fantastic Boston Teen Author Festival for helping to promote the BBF and this session in particular. Here at the BBF, we're always looking for different ways to help us keep this festival free and fun for everyone, because here's a hint, it's far from free for us to produce. So this year we're trying something new. We're raffling off a Vespa. Tickets are only available today. You can look for the friendly volunteers who are wearing t-shirts with a Vespa on them. So your odds are actually pretty good. We estimate the Vespa glove box can hold 2 to 4 books, and we hope this factoid will matter a great deal to one of you come this time next year. Good luck, and thank you so much for your support. And now I'd love to turn things over to our host for today's YA keynote, Samantha Lane, host of the YouTube channel Thoughts on Tomes.
Hello, everybody. I am here to talk to the wonderful Cami Garcia, who is the author of Unbreakable and is one half of the writing duo that brought The Beautiful Creatures to all of us and its phenomenally popular sequels. Cami has been one of the most successful authors of the YA contemporary fantasy genre. Now, with The Lovely Reckless, Cami is turning her pen in a new direction, to contemporary realistic fiction with a gritty romance set in the world of street racing. So, Cami?
I'm going to actually stand up because it's... Okay, I feel like Tony Robbins. I'm not used to having a mic where I can, like, walk around. So, one thing I wanted to talk to you about today is I have a strange publication story. I was a teacher for 17 years, and I wrote Beautiful Creatures on a Dare with my best friend, Margaret. Like, we were not writing partners. We were best friends for 11 years. I taught all three of her daughters, and we wrote the book on a dare from 7 students in my fantasy book club, including her 2 daughters. And basically, there was no Hunger Games. Mortal Instruments was out. I think New Moon, the second Twilight book, was out. But it was really a time where there wasn't as much, you know, there wasn't a lot of dystopian, except for the classics. There was really kind of vampires and werewolves and urban fantasy, unless you moved into adult, which is what, you know, I did as a reader. And so the kids were complaining. The girls were saying, why does the boy always get to be the supernatural and have all the powers? The girl never gets to, you know, do anything exciting except for fall in love. And the boys were really disappointed because they said, like, all the guys are jerks and they're super aloof and, like, difficult and, like, you know, it, like, gives all the nice guys a bad name. Like, no girls want to go out with us because we don't have, like, a fancy enough car and we're not mysterious enough. So they kept talking about this, and Margie wasn't allowed in the book club, but it was at her house, so she would usually have her ear pressed to the door. And they also talked about sense of place. We talked about classic fantasy a lot, and they were saying how a lot of urban fantasy didn't have a strong sense of place, which has changed a lot since 2008. And they wanted a book where it didn't feel like it could happen anywhere. It felt like it was in a very specific, you know, town, region, you know, where the setting was almost like a character. So I had just had my daughter, my second child, so I was allowed to have Diet Coke again. And Margie and I went to our favorite Mexican restaurant. And she was a writer, and she wrote video games, and she owned a video game development company. And I was a huge comic book fan, and we talked about how easy it would be, and we're like, why doesn't someone just, like, create some other supernaturals besides, you know, shapeshifters and, you know, vampires and werewolves? Like, it's kind of like creating superheroes, which is the coolest thing ever. So we came up with all these ideas. We, like, wrote them on napkins. And then Margie's like, we didn't really call it a book. We called it a story. Margie's like, well, we could totally do this. So we went back to her house, and we, like, present the napkins to the teens, especially, like, I think there was, like, 4 of them. And they didn't seem that impressed, which is disappointing. And especially because I was their teacher, so usually they were always pretended to be impressed if I did something, as long as it wasn't her idea. So Margie was like, you know, Emma, like, doesn't this sounds really cool, don't you think? You know, like, the supernaturals will be kind of like a cross between, like, X-Men and witches, and they'll all have really specific power sets. It will all be really, you know, like, the rules of the universe will be really tight. We're going to set it in a small southern town, and we're going to write it from a boy's point of view. And Emma was like, yeah, it sounds great. And she's like, but, like, you're not going to do it. And Margie was like, what do you mean? And in Emma's defense, Margie had written the beginning of 50 or 60 books, and that was it. Like, the first, you know, 4 chapters. And so Emma said, well, like, you say you're going to do it, and for like a week you're probably going to do it, and then you're going to quit because you never finish anything. And I was like, but like, I was a teacher, and teachers finish everything. So I was like, I will finish. So I told Margie, I'm like, okay, maybe we're not doing this before, but now we are doing it. So we wrote the book like serialized fiction for the teens. We did not have a system. We used Word. We did not track changes. We did a big outline. The first thing we did was like map out the whole universe, all the rules, because to us, like, that's what matters. That's the difference for me between a lot of really classic fantasy and science fiction and some of the stuff I read today. Like, the, you know, like, I love like Cassie Clare and Holly Black, but some things I read, I'm like, immediately they're breaking their own rules, and I'm like, you need more video game and comic book background, because then you will know you cannot break the rules of your own universe, and you need to know what they are. So Margie and I like knew the origin of the universe like to the degree that we never used. And our editor was very frightened of our like series Bible, and she was like, please don't show that to me again. So she was like, I don't want to know about dark matter or any of this stuff. Like, this is like, I did not read Hyperion or Dune. This is way above my pay grade. So she's like, this is a romantic like urban fantasy. That's it. And we were like, okay, we'll let you believe that. So we wrote it like serialized fiction. We mapped out the, like, we knew how it would end and meet like already. But it was kind of like, how are we going to get there? So we mapped out the main points, and then we split it up. Margie did chapter like 1 and 2. I hate the beginning of anything. Like, I can write, you know, the devil out of the end, not the beginning. And then I did 3 and 4, and we swapped, and we would just write over each other's work. So like, I would delete all the bad stuff she wrote without telling her or asking her. And then I would write new stuff. Or sometimes I would delete like the first half of her sentence, but leave the second half. And then, we would always say, she'd be like, that's, you know, a terrible line. And I was like, you wrote it. And she's like, no, you wrote it. And I'm like, well, you wrote half of it. So we gave it to the teens. We had to give it to them every morning because they weren't allowed to, like, download on campus. They had to download before 7:30. And then as we were going, it started spreading virally through several high schools in L.A. where my elementary school students had graduated and moved on to, and my fantasy book club high school students were attending. And we started getting, like, I'm never even on Facebook except to, like, post, like, this stuff, like, you know, for people to look at on my Facebook page. But I started getting messages, like, from kids I didn't know asking if we would send them the chapters, because it became a thing, like, if you didn't know someone who had them, you couldn't get it. So Margie was like, this is strange. Seems like people actually like this. And it was kind of like writing a bedtime story where, you know, if your child likes spaceships, then there are spaceships in the story. So for us, it was written from a boy's point of view. It was a Southern Gothic. It was about, you know, a boy in a small Southern town where nothing ever happens. It's very insulated. And one of the things that was going on was the kids were reading To Kill a Mockingbird in school and telling me how it was the worst book they've ever read, like piercing knives into my heart. And saying how it was not socially relevant, like none of that was like, that didn't matter anymore. And I was like, okay, well, you know, not only is there racial discrimination, there's like all different kinds of discrimination. And in the 50s, fantasy and science fiction was kind of a way to expose and talk about kind of scary and hard things in a safe way. So in our book, the people who, they are reading To Kill a Mockingbird, but the people who are being discriminated against are actually people who are different in any way. If you aren't from the town, if you aren't from the South, if you don't have an accent, if you don't dress the right way. So when this new girl arrives in school and she's wearing Converse and she like reads all the required reading books, it's a problem. No one likes her. And Ethan, our main character, he does kind of like her, and he starts, you know, wants to become friends with her. And eventually realizes that her Converse are like the least of her problems. She comes from a family of cursed supernaturals. And on her 16th birthday, her fate will be decided. And she will either be good or evil. And she has no choice. So the first book is really a countdown to her birthday. So it's like, how do we stop it? What do we do? And there's a lot of adults in the book. You know, his father and his grandmother figure are super important. His goofy best friend's mother is, like, you know, heading the charge against, like, the new girl and her evil family because they don't go to the church and stuff like that. So it's got a lot of humor in it. And We had no intention of publishing it. When we were done, Margie and I were so, it's so embarrassing to admit how stupid we were. Like, we decided we were going to make a website online. Like, we didn't actually know how to do this, but Margie's sister-in-law did. We were going to make a website and put the book up online for free so people could read it. Because we had no idea what self-publishing was. And we didn't really think of it as a book because it was a, you know, it lived in our computer in Word. And thankfully, Margie's oldest friend is the middle grade author Pseudonymous Bosch, and who wrote the name of this book is Secret. And he sent it to his agent in New York without telling us, which is how we got an agent. So everything we did was super accidental. And like all through the process, like they would ask us about like, they would say, oh, you're going to have ARCs. And like Margie would call me like, what do you think that is? And I was like, I don't know, but it probably doesn't have animals in it. Like we didn't know what anything was. And I said, like, don't ask questions because if they find out how stupid we are, they'll kick us to the curb. So just like, if you don't know something, we'll figure it out later. Eventually, like our editor figured out we didn't know anything and they started explaining stuff to us. And we met Holly Black, who was like, you two need to come to lunch with me immediately. And, you know, a lot of people kind of took us under their wing and told us how things worked. And then YA sort of blew up. It got, you know, suddenly there were tons of books and, you know, the shelves were packed with, you know, urban fantasy and dystopian and science fiction. And I kind of watched it happen and I watched, and, you know, in our book, you know, I'm a number one New York Times bestseller. It hit USA Today, Wall Street Journal, you know, Publishers Weekly. The movie rights were optioned. Like, all these great things happened to the book. And part of that is because there were not 10,000 books coming out at the same time. And part of that is because it was different. And, you know, people were looking for something different. But I always say, those things are all luck. None of those have to do with, like, my book is super brilliant and someone's book who doesn't hit the list or who doesn't get an agent right away, their book sucks. Like, publishing is a lot of luck. It's a lot of the right place at the right time or getting what you wrote into the hands of the person who's obsessed with, like, robotics. So for us, it was a perfect storm. We had good luck. We had this huge tome of a manuscript that was super different. And we had, you know, and the publishing industry was looking for urban fantasy with romance. So it was perfect. And over, you know, the years, there's a lot of books in that series. I wrote another urban fantasy series called The Legion, which was the same, you know, similar vein, totally different characters, more like the show Supernatural. But again, it had romance. And all these books started coming out, and I started going online, like more than just Facebook. Like I found out about Twitter and all these things I didn't know about. And a couple years ago, I found out about NaNoWriMo. I'm friends with Aaron, not friends with, but I know Aaron Morgenstern. And I found out about NaNoWriMo, which I thought was super interesting. And I was convinced I was going to do it until I realized how many words you had to write a day. And I was like, I've never done that before, so that doesn't seem like it's going to happen. But I was really, as a teacher, I was really excited to see all these teens and, like, young writers that would come up to me at events and talk to me about, like, their writing, and they had a whole book, and, like, they were way more motivated than Margie and I. And then I started noticing online there were people, writers and, you know, such, saying how NaNoWriMo was ridiculous, or trying to write a book, you know, if you didn't have an MFA, like, you were unprofessional, you didn't know what you were doing, and that, like, really pissed me off. Like, that, like, enraged the teacher in me, which is how I ended up on the NaNoWriMo Writers Board. Because for me, I mean, I don't have an MFA. I have a master's, but it's in language and literacy and teaching special ed. It has nothing to do with writing. And it's about how to teach other, you know, children to write, like in elementary school. It is not how to, like, write the great American novel. I also have tons of incredibly prolific and talented friends who did not get an MFA, some of whom didn't even finish college. Not that I am encouraging that. I think everyone should go to as much school as they want. But, you know, you can go to school and be an engineer. You can major in whatever you want. Like, writing is writing. And it felt sort of elitist, like, if you don't have the money to get this kind of degree or you don't go through this kind of process, you're not a real writer. And it especially felt damaging to me for younger people or, you know, people like Margie's, you know, Margie, like, if we hadn't have been dared, she would not have written a book. And all she wanted to do her entire life was write a book. But she was scared to do it. So I spent much of my free time making videos and going online, being super obnoxious, and, like, writing articles for, you know, guest posts for Huffington Post and places like that where people could read and get angry with me. And I said, you know, the real deal is, like, maybe there's a muse. If there is, someone should send it to me. I do not have a muse. There's no magical fairy dust that, like, the gods of writing come and sprinkle down over you, and then you're Neil Gaiman. That does not happen, okay? Like, I get up, I put on my I'm in my pajamas. I usually change into fresh pajamas. And then I sit for a long time and think about things that I could do that do not involve writing. Because I don't want to, especially draft. Like, I don't want to have to, you know, take the risk and put those words on the page. Sometimes I write from an outline. I'm a plotter. I have the whole thing in front of me. But I can still sit there and, you know, even if I know what happens in that chapter, I cannot make anything interesting come out. You know, it's all garbage. And that's okay. That's one of the things I like about NaNoWriMo is the idea that you know, since you're writing so fast and you have the support of this community and the goal is to get the words down, you're not editing, you're not trying to be perfect. You're literally trying to write the crappiest draft possible. And, you know, just like, I mean, my stepdad compares it to, you know, he was an undercover cop in stolen cars, but when he retired, he started building motorcycles and cars, classic cars. And he said, like, it's like when you go to the junkyard and you get, like, an engine that's literally, or motor or body that's a piece of junk, and you bring it home and, you know, you restore it, you work on it. But again, like, he's like, you can't, you know, if you don't have the engine, like, you can't start fixing it up. And writing is the same way. If you don't have the words, if you don't have a story on the paper, no matter how bad it is, you have nothing to fix. So for me, when people would say, oh, you can't write a book in a month, you know, I don't think you can write a finished book in a month, you know, that's completely edited and perfect and ready to send out to an agent. But you can certainly write a draft in a month. I know people who write drafts in weeks. It's super crazy and manic, and, like, I don't want to hear about it because it makes me have hives, but it can be done. And a lot of people who are self-published, I'm really good friends, you know, with Jamie McGuire and Abby Glines and Colleen Hoover, who started out self-published. You know, they write their drafts in, like, a week or two because they write, like, around the clock, and they write the draft really fast, and then they spend a long time working on it. But they just want, like, that modeling clay. So, you know, one of my missions is kind of to tell people that, well, first of all, if I can get published, anyone can get published. Like, me and Margie are fools. Like, we fell, like, we rolled down the hill at, like, every given opportunity. We, like, got invited to things. Like, we were keynoting things we didn't even know we were keynoting. Or we would, like, prepare. That's why I'm like, I can only prepare so many speeches. Like, we prepare a presentation for one thing, and they'd be like, we're not actually talking about that. And we were like, okay. Like, we used to have, like, visuals until we went to schools where we were in the cafeteria, and there was, like, no AV equipment. And so then I was like, forget the visuals, no PowerPoint. This is over with. Like, we were literally standing on tables in the cafeteria. Because we also spent a lot of time, I taught in underserved schools, and we spent a lot of time going to those kinds of schools. So I was like, we have to be able to just, like, do this on the fly with no equipment. And I feel like with writing, you really just need an idea and a pen and a piece of paper. I don't even write on the computer anymore when I write my drafts. I write them in notebooks, which is a horrifying thought. But that's how I prevent myself from, you know, being super perfectionistic, because my handwriting is so bad, I can't read it. So I feel like the main thing is that, you know, if you want, it doesn't have to be writing, like, whether you want to write, you want to paint, you want to learn to play the guitar, like, whatever you want to do, like, don't wait. You know, I was almost probably, I mean, I was in my middle 30s before I wrote. Margie was, you know, in her late 30s. Like, don't wait until you're in your 30s to do the thing you want to do. If you're young and you know what you want to do, do it. But if you are, you know, that age or older, and you've never, you know, taken the leap to do the thing you want to do, like, do it now. Like, it's not worth waiting. The worst thing that can happen is it's bad, and you have to go back to the drawing board. but I feel like a lot of times, I mean, I have a lot of self-doubt when I work, and it's very difficult to deal with because I have ADHD, I suffer from anxiety, so that like immediately is like you suck all day long. But you have to kind of like plow through that because like you can't get the dream if you don't chase the dream. There's a quote saying, you know, like the dream is free, the hustle not provided. Like you have to go after the thing that you want and you can't, and I don't care like what fancy author is online talking about how you can't write a book in a month, you can't become published if you don't have a degree or whatever. Like they don't know anything, clearly. I mean, like I'm a perfect example of that, which I have pointed out at many dinners, and you know, they were not that excited about it. So that's the main thing I just wanted to say is that whenever I go to things like this, I really just want people to, you know, to write, to do whatever it is you want to do and not let other people stop you. Because life is short and, you know, I'm always expecting to get hit by a bus at any given time. So I feel like, you know, just do the thing you want to do. And if you do it, then go on Twitter and tell me you did it. And I mean, or, you know, Sam can put you on her fancy channel. I haven't even been on her fancy channel. Like there are, you know, I meet kids now, you know, kids, teens and 20 somethings who have like YouTube channels who have more, you know, subscribers than I have readers. So like the world is different than, you know, as my son always says, did they have the radio when you were young? Like you're definitely not getting a car. You're going to walk everywhere until you're 20. So I'm going to answer some of her questions and some of your questions. But like I said, my main mission always, like it's the teacher in me. I just want to see everyone go after the thing that they want and not let other people stop them because you're your own worst enemy or like the so-called expert online telling you how you can't do something. Like one of the best writing coaches out there who will totally respond to you if you tweet him is, his name is James Scott Bell. He was one of the highest paid script doctors in Hollywood. He has no writing training whatsoever. He's self-trained. He's taken courses. He's read every book there is about writing craft. But he did not go to college for that. That's not what his degree was in. And he gets paid a lot of money. But more importantly, he switched to fiction and writing books for writers. Because he said, like, everyone would tell me you can't do this because you don't have the right background. And he was like, I can do whatever I want. So he's obviously much braver than me, but at any rate, I feel like that's what you need to do. And then you can go online and tell me about it, and I will cheer you on. I have a horrific video, a very unprofessional video series on my blog with a video a day for NaNoWriMo. A lot of them are just me eating ice cream telling you to, like, keep going.
Which is perfect.
I know. Yeah. Trust me. My son was like, I want to start a YouTube channel. I'm like, I'm not the person to help you with this. I assure you. If you've seen any of my videos.
Well, you really touched on your background as a fantasy author. And I want to talk about how the transition to contemporary has been for you because you've been such a fantasy person and a genre person. And now you're switching complete gears. So how was that and your inspiration for that and stuff? Because I know you mentioned your stepfather with this book. So.
It's hard. I kind of had The Lovely Reckless is a story about a girl who's lives in Washington, D.C., which is where I grew up, and her boyfriend gets killed in kind of a violent situation, and she was there, but she can't really remember everything that happened. She's suffering from PTSD, and she goes, like, through a downward spiral, which all kind of happens before the book really starts. And at the beginning of the book, she makes a really stupid mistake and gets kicked out of school, and her mom says, like, I don't know what to do with you anymore. I can't help you. You're going to go live with your dad. And her dad is an undercover cop in stolen cars, which is what my stepdad did when I was growing up. It's very exciting. It involved, like, proving I could get out of the trunk of a car in case I was abducted. There's a lot of concern about me being abducted. I was like, I'm sure that whoever abducted me would give me back, but he did not agree. And, you know, and a lot of his stories are funny. I mean, they're funny now. They were not funny then. Like, for any teen girl can attest. Like, my brother, who's younger than me, chaperoned my first date. Like, I fought competitively. My brother got beat up all the time. And I literally, my stepdad's, he tries not to be as chauvinistic now, but he was a very chauvinistic, tall Italian guy who looked kind of like Rocky in the first movie. with that like leather jacket. And, you know, and he was undercover, so he looked slightly like a criminal. And he would, I said, like, John, seriously, like, why is he going with me? Like, what is he going to do? Like, you know, he gets beat up all the time at school. If some guy tries to, like, attack me or abduct me, what is Andrew going to do? And he's like, he's going to call me on the payphone. And I was like, but that was, like, all the time what our arguments were like. You know, he used to, like, we had, like, you know, critical skills where, like, you know, I had, like, I can get out of zip ties, handcuffs, because God forbid if you are abducted and handcuffed and, you know, that your Hannibal Lecter wanders off, you know, to go make stew out of someone and you have the opportunity to escape, you better know how to get out of handcuffs, you know, or zip ties, which, by the way, hardly anyone even used back then. It was like the 70s and the 80s. And then old cars didn't have a trunk release in the back, which, by the way, they do now. So if you're in a new car, you can always get out of the trunk. But my stepdad was like, you need to be able to go prove you can get out of the trunk of a car before you can go out, like, by yourself. So I would have to go in the trunk of his disgusting car while he, like, smoked Merits, which, like, kids, this was, like, many moons ago when you didn't have to wear a seatbelt. And he would be, like, yelling orders, like, muffled orders through the back of the car. And then sometimes I would, like, yell at him. And then he'd be like, I'll be back in a few minutes. I'm going to go get some donuts. And he would just leave me there. Like, if I sassed him, he'd be like, let's see how you do on your own. I can get out of the trunk of a car now. I learned a lot of practical skills. And a lot of my friends, like, you know, my writer friends, they know all these stories. And they think they're hilarious. Some of them have even met John. And it is a unique experience to kind of grow up with a cop. And in the story, Frankie, who is not me, that would be too hard. She's not based on me. But she has friends like I had, and she lives in a place like where I lived, and her high school is similar to mine. She goes to live with her dad. She goes to public high school for the first time, and she meets this boy, Marco, who's, you know, kind of the resident bad boy. He's an illegal street racer, very cute. Kind of seems like the stereotype, you know, like a bad boy, everyone, you know, gets kicked out, you know, gets suspended all the time. But she comes to find out that there's actually a lot more to him than, you know, that. And some of the things he does, he's doing for reasons that, you know, he doesn't talk about and not many people know. And so she kind of falls for him. And it's very problematic if you are, you know, if you were dating a guy who, you know, races illegally on the street and your dad is an undercover cop, particularly in stolen cars. This is frowned upon. So, you know, much drama ensues. And again, also the underlying, you know, thing is she also desperately wants to find, you know, she wants to vindicate and help the police catch this person who killed her boyfriend, who really was like just her oldest friend that she grew up with. And so she has to kind of figure out what she wants to do and who she is. And Contemporary seemed really daunting to me because, A, there's no magic to fix anything. And also, you cannot kill that many people in Contemporary. Like, my agent was like, you can't take out a whole bunch of people. Like, unless you're going to write, like, a war book. That's not going to be popular. That's depressing. So, and I, you know, I like dark. So it definitely has dark, but I don't kill a bunch of people. And it was hard, you know. You have to, like, dig deep. But I felt like I had a really unique experience and a unique kind of family situation. So I wanted to do something with it. And it didn't lend itself to urban fantasy. It didn't really lend itself to magic. Like, I didn't want the cars to fly or anything. So, I mean, mostly, like, Holly Black and some of my writing, my friends and critique partners bullied me into it. But it's, and it's hard. I think it's really hard to write contemporary. But at the same time, it's fun because if this, you know, if the world is hanging in the balance, there's not a lot of time for, like, you know, banter and, like, you know, getting into normal teen trouble and kissing. You know, you have to spend a lot more time, you know, fighting, like, the villains and racing against the clock to break the curse. Mm-hmm. So that part of it I really liked. But it was scary. It's scary to go from, like, one genre
right,
to another.
Right, which you're so used to at this point, to go totally. Into something
that was like,
different.
I can write urban fantasy in my sleep. Right. I can come up with that, like, nothing. This, and all of a sudden, I was like, this shouldn't be hard. It's, like, regular stuff. Mm-hmm. But you have to kind of look for the regular stuff that is, you know, interesting and meaningful. And I also do like action, so that's like, I was like, we have to have cars or something. Like, we can't just go to school and wander around and go to the movies.
Right. Yeah. Frankie actually says a really good line regarding, she's kind of examining the differences sort of between her feelings for Marco and her feelings for her ex-boyfriend. And she says this great line about kind of the differences of love and kind of almost comparing first love to forever love and stuff like that. And I really liked the comment on your first love might not be your forever love, and it's very different. So can you kind of talk about that and kind of, because the stereotype is to have these YA contemporaries that have, you fall in love with the first guy or girl you see, and you're together
That's
forever.
It, right.
Yep. And this is very different.
Yeah. So for her, her first love was really a guy that she grew up with. He was like her best friend. You know, they did everything together. And naturally, as, you know, they got older and he became super cute and, you know, they ended up dating. And, you know, she even kind of comments like that if she had gone to a big public school or she'd had kind of like a more exposure to different people, she might not have even ended up with him. But, you know, they always say, you know, you fall in love with your best friend. And he was her best friend. And because a lot of people will say, well, how did she get over him so quickly? And you know, it's interesting because she wonders that too, but she comes to kind of realize that like the love that they also had was also like more of like, you know, the love you have for your best friend.
Mm-hmm. Familiarity. Kind
yeah.
Of
and that like,
nostalgia.
You know, or where you just click and it's like your person, mm-hmm. but it doesn't necessarily mean that's like the person you're madly in love with, but that's like a person you love who's going to like understand you and always be in your life. And, sometimes, you know, some people, a lot of people have really responded well to that. Some people, you know, will say, oh, well, but she fell for Marco super fast. And isn't that like insta-love, which is like, I'm not a fan of that like term. I think it sounds ridiculous. I'm probably too old. Like, it doesn't sound like Instagram to me. It sounds like instant Polaroid film. So what I say is one of the things that's really different and hard to understand, depending on your background, is, you know, if like Marco lives in like Section 8 housing in the projects, like where some of my friends and like my boyfriends lived. And when you live in a situation where, and you know, and where I taught, like if you live in a situation where your day-to-day safety is at risk and you always have to have your guard up, you maybe have parents, like maybe they're around, maybe they're not, maybe they're kicking your butt, maybe they disappear for weeks and days at a time. Maybe you're raising, you know, or helping to raise your younger brothers and sisters. You may be doing, you know, things that you feel like you don't have a choice about to, you know, pay rent, get food. And when you're in that kind of a situation and it's like being in a constant state of fight or flight. Like for me, it was very hard to trust anyone. And it was kind of like, I don't know if you've ever had that experience where you meet like a friend and you like immediately know like this is your person and you're going to be best friends and you totally click and like by the end of the day you're madly in love with your friend and you're like, we are best friends forever. Like I equate falling for someone in the same way, because I think that when it's kind of like when a long time ago people would get married really fast, like during wars and things like that where there were really intense situations going on and you didn't know how much time you would have. I feel like when you're living in like a battle zone, it's the same thing. It's a crisis situation all the time. And when you meet someone who understands you or you can trust on any level, that connection is very, very intense. And it's interesting because none of the people who made those comments are ever teens. They're always people who are like 30 or 40. And they're generally people who didn't grow up in that background. Mm-hmm. Because for me, like, if I trusted someone, like I was in 100% because it was so rare. And, you know, if you met someone who had a similar experience as you, that you had and really could get where you were coming from, like that bond is really strong really quickly. So for me, it was more like they found each other and they found like this person who really understood like parts of themselves that they hadn't shared with anyone. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And now they, you know, and I don't think they really understood until they were like forced to face them. You know, the other person kind of called them out on it.
Right. Absolutely. So you kind of briefly mentioned before that you jumped into adult books earlier when you were like a teenager because YA wasn't a thing until very recently. You know, it wasn't a huge shelf at Barnes & Noble, a huge section. So what are some books that you've since read, because you're very in with the YA community, that you've read that you wished that you would have had as a teenager?
There's a lot. I mean, I went from like, you know, Judy Blume and The Outsiders to like Stephen King. There's like, you know, there is no real middle ground. I mean, I think what's nice about YA now is there's so much to choose from. There's, you know, LGBT, there's thrillers, there's friendship stories, there's romance. You can kind of, you know, you can, I mean, there's, you know, stories. Like, my book has a lot of diversity with, you know, some of the characters, but it's not, like, about diversity. There's books where, like, if you're looking for a book because, you know, you're experiencing, you know, discrimination or you're fighting against, you know, sexism or whatever it is, like, there's a book for it. I mean, it might be hard to find, but I feel like that's where a librarian comes in, or booktubers, bookstagrammers, bloggers, where you can go online and, like, read reviews and, like, a lot of them also post, like, lists. They'll be like, if you're looking for a great LGBT romance, here's a list of books. I'm trying to think of some contemporary, too. Like, some of my favorite fantasies, I love Holly Black. I love everything she writes. The Coldest Girl in Cold Town was, like, really well-received a few years ago. But she has a series, a YA series that came out before that, called The Curse Workers, which is basically, like, supernatural organized crime. And it's also about a family where no one can trust each other. Like, you, like, they love each other, but, like, they're all con men. So, like, you can't trust what anyone's telling you. It's really, really, really interesting because, when I was younger, like, I had a non-traditional kind of strange family, and we were in kind of constant state of alert. And there weren't a lot of books. Like, all the books were like, your parents are super perfect and they love you so much and they're married, or maybe they get divorced and that's like the most dramatic thing that happens in the book. Like, my parents were divorced. Like, I don't even know. Like, I don't know how they even had me. They were married such little time. But, you know, I mean, and then my parents remarried. So I had like two whole other families. Like, most of the books were like everybody, you know, like you go to your parents, ask them for advice, and they give you advice, and then it all works out. That was not like the way things worked for me. So the idea of like having, you know, family members that you knew loved you, but you didn't 100% like trust, or you didn't know if you told them if they were going to rat you out to your parents. Like, I have four brothers. Like, one of them is like a professional informant, literally. Like, I was like, I hope you're going to be a narc when you grow up. Because, like, I mean, he told on people he didn't even know, everyone. And he now makes video games, so I don't know how that, like, if that helps him, but I mean, I hope so. But I also love, Adam Silvera has some amazing books. I'm trying to think of my favorite contemporary. I just did a post about my favorite, most favorite contemporaries. I love anything. It's a kind of a quiet book. It's called Still Waters. And it has that kind of outsider's feeling to it, like where you know from the beginning something's going to go very wrong. And, like, you can tell that the character knows too, but, like, you know, but he can't stop the train and you don't want to get off the train. Like, you want to know how this is going to play out. And I am really good at guessing, you know, plots. And I totally thought I knew what was going to happen and I was wrong. In fantasy, I love Marie Lu always. I blurbed her first series, Legend. I love Renée Adier. She writes a great series called The Wrath and the Dawn. It's the first book. It's very diverse.
It's amazing.
Marie Rutowski is another person. She wrote The Winner's Curse. And those are like fantasies where they have super rich worlds. The other thing with urban fantasy now that, you know, I'm not as big a fan of is there's like... there's like regular books masquerading as urban fantasy, where basically it's a regular, the magical place is exactly like our world, except for all the names are different and you can't pronounce them. But there's no like actual social structure. There's no government that's that different, or they're mentioned one time. Like, it has a veneer of fantasy, but it's not actually a fantasy or science fiction. Like, it's like science fiction where they're in a ship that you know nothing about, and you know, like, there's a rebellion. I'm like, it looks like someone watched Star Wars too many times. I love Illumini by Jay Kristoff and Amy Kaufman, and she has another series that she writes that's amazing. I still love Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist mm-hmm. by David Levithan and Rachel Cohn. He has a lot of other great books. One is called Every Day, which is like a crazy premise I cannot explain, but it's so good. And I love Eleanor and Park. Like, I like contemporary books where, you know, there's, I like it. Like, I love that book because there's like music and they're reading comic books and it feels super real. And you can picture, like, I can go out and get all the comic books that they mention mm-hmm. in the book. Mm-hmm. And again, they fall in love and there are some extreme circumstances going on that you don't expect. And you think you're just reading a love story or a romance, but it's way more than that. I like Julie Murphy. I love mm-hmm. Dumpling. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I feel like I like the new normal, the idea that now the heroine doesn't have to be white and skinny and perfect. And, you know, the boy doesn't have to be like, you know, the quarterback on the football team. You know, like the heroine and the hero can be nerdy and, you know, chubby or quirky. They can wear striped socks. Like all these different kinds of people are heroes and heroines, just like us, you know, where you can kind of like be quirky and proud. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like Harry Potter kind of like changed a lot of that and mm-hmm. made it cool to be different.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think we have about 10 minutes left. We're going to do a few audience questions. So if you guys are going to ask a question, if I call on you, you have to go up to the podium and speak in the mic. So be prepared for that. If you have
this
any social anxiety.
This is your big chance to ask whatever you want.
But anything you want to ask, raise hand.
Let's see who's the bravest.
Shy, yeah.
Come. Right. Just go line. It's like Comic-Con. You can right. just go line
just
up.
Just line up at the mic. Whatever we can get through, we will.
Because I feel like it's hard to be like the question asking person.
So my favorite book by you is The Beautiful Creatures, but I am curious how you felt about the movie adaptation.
I mean, honestly, we lived in LA. I mean, I'm sure Warner Brothers didn't appreciate this. I thought it was like really expensive fan art. You know, like it's like it's, you know, it's like the book, and the sets were amazing. I loved Alden. The boy who played Ethan was like exactly the way I imagined Ethan. Like, I mean, when you went on the set, every single book that we mentioned that was on his bookshelf was on the shelf. So it was kind of like watching part of our book come to life. But we in no way had the illusion that we were going to see a movie that was going to be exactly like the book. Because we had, you know, like I had worked in production. We had seen this happen. Mm-hmm. So even though we tried to prepare our readers, they were not having it. Like they were like, where's the dog? Like, where are the ants? And now seeing what people are doing, I mean, I'm hoping it might have a chance in the future to end up on something like Netflix, because it really is so long, it would lend itself much better to TV or like a little mini series than a movie. But I thought it was fun. And I think if you love the books and you want to be able to see the settings and like get a feel for what the town would be like, it's a great way to do it. They used all my reference photos for the houses and stuff like that. So I felt like that stuff was really cool. The Luna Libre was really interesting too, because we didn't have any like pictures of that and it looked exactly the way we imagined. So that was really creepy, because I was like, you know, like we didn't, I mean, we just had the description in the book, which is good, but it's not like that good. And we went in and it looked like exactly the way we would have wanted to, mm-hmm. you know, to create it. So that was pretty cool. You're always lucky. Like complaining about your movie is like a first world problem. You know what I mean? It's pretty obnoxious to be like, oh, my movie. Like,
there's a few
we lucked
that.
Out. The way I also see it is, like, I don't really like movies based on books anyways. They're never going to be as good. It's, like, fun to go. But, like, to me, unfortunately, more people watch movies and see commercials than read books. So that's, like, a way for them to find books. So we got a ton of readers. Mm-hmm. So for me, that was really the game, was I want all these people to see the commercial or the movie and be like, I want to read these books. And I want to read more books like these. So, I mean, I wasn't allowed to say that during the press junket because that's not a very good promotion for the movie. But that was like my goal as like the teacher in me, was like, I just want to get people to find out there's these books and start reading.
You mentioned that in Beautiful Creatures, there's a lot of adults around, and I think that is something, you know, I think usually when I read young adult fiction, like the first thing the author does is like get rid of all the adults, like kidnapped, killed, orphans. They always have to get rid of the adults so the kids can solve the problem. And I was wondering if it caused you any complications to keep all those adults around, what you thought was more interesting about that?
No, you can't really populate a weird southern town without adults. Really old ones are particularly important. My family is from a small southern town. Like, the aunts are based completely on my great aunts that are who are now long dead, but my cousin would point out would love to have been in the book. So, like, those characters we didn't even make up. And also, like, I mean, in Breakable, the mom does die, but she's still, like her presence is really prominent, and then other adults are introduced. And in The Lovely Reckless, like Frankie, I mean, her mom's in it, too, and other, there's another adult, there's a guy named Chief who's their auto shop teacher who's really, really important to them, and, you know, dispenses kind of, you know, strange advice that ends up being really helpful. But I feel like when you're a teen, I mean, part of the gig is like your life is, you know, affected by adults, whether or not you like them, love them, disagree with them, love to fight with them. And it feels kind of weird unless you're doing like a Nick and Nora where it's like one night and you're out. It feels weird that like there's no, you know, you're in school but there's no teachers. Like, again, I don't like the blank slate book where, like, everyone is kind of wandering through, like, a you know, colorless, nameless school and going through class. It's like the Peanuts, you know, and, like, the teacher's making noise, but you can't imagine what any, you know, what anyone looks like or what's happening. And I feel like I also like to show the flaws in adults because I think when you're a teenager sometimes, you know, like with my stepdad, it's like he was a cop. Like, he seemed like he was going to always be right, but I was... You know, one of the questions in the book is like, is it ever okay to do the wrong thing for the right reason? And when you're an undercover cop, like, the answer is no. You know, but my answer was yes. So, like, you know, I butted heads with him all the time. And when you're a teenager, like, that was one of my main sources of drama and strife and stress in my life. So to, like, pretend that, like, my only stress was, like, going to school and, like, not having the right clothes, like, I had way bigger problems than that. I also had the wrong clothes, but... That was like, you know, that was minor compared to like the drama of, you know, my parents and other things like that. And just if you need to make any comments like this, please put them on Twitter. It is the only social media platform my mom has not cracked. So any, you know, anything questionable goes on Twitter. Everything else she's like infiltrated like right. The CIA.
We have about 5 minutes, so we have to be a little choppy, but... Okay. You
my question was just about collaborating with another writer, and you know, does that make it more difficult if you like butt heads?
It made it easier for us, but we were not setting out to write a book. We also knew each other for 11 years, and the more writers I meet, the more I think that it would be really hard unless you know that person, because a lot of writers, I mean, you know, not all, but I have not much ego. A lot of writers have an ego. And they do not want you deleting their words without track changes. So, like, you have to figure out, I think, like, what David does is he usually writes with partners where, like, he'll write the boy and they'll write the girl. So they each have ownership of their own character. Mm-hmm. So I think the key is finding someone who's writing you really respect, preferably who writes better than you. Do not pick someone who writes worse than you. And, you know, someone you can get along with and argue with in, like, a normal way. Like, don't pick someone you never had a fight with because, like, you know, that person could go rogue. You have no idea what to expect. And then come up with, like, a system that works and try something small, like a novella or a short story. Do not dive into, like, the Faulkner novel. I mean, I'm serious. I've heard some really terrifying stories. But I think that, like, I've also have friends, you know, my friends who write Illumini, they love writing together. So I think it's also like finding the person, like, you know, I always say with Margie and I, it's like finding, you know, like your chocolate and your peanut butter to make the Reese's. Like, you need someone, you want to both bring something to the table, basically. And you want ground rules from the jump. Don't, I mean, we were winging it because we weren't trying to get published. But if there's a clock or stress involved, like there's stakes, you want to have ground rules. Like, this is what we do if we disagree. You know, this is what happens if we have a fight, that sort of thing. No one can hold the draft hostage. Like, I would be like, if you want to hold the draft hostage, that's awesome. Finish it while you're at it. Margie and I fought all the time, but we were really like sisters where we fought about everything but the book. We fought about, like, why I needed to bring so much luggage on trips, why she would pretend the internet wasn't working because she didn't want to send me the draft on time. she hadn't done her work, stuff like that.
Awesome. So I think we are right out of time, but thank you all for joining us, and thank you, Cammie.
Thank you. I'm going to thank you guys for listening. And I'm online. I'm slightly bad at my Facebook, but I do try to answer all my at mentions on Twitter. So if you have a question or you at me, I do try to answer people. But if it's a writing question, like, please go on my blog first, because there's so many, I mean, they're horrible to watch, but there's lots of videos of me talking about writing and showing you my office and my techniques. So some of it might be in there. And then I have a press page, which basically is presses like interviews,
right,
or posts that people have put up, which also a lot of them are about writing. So I want people to watch. I am not like you. I do not have thousands of subscribers. I want people to watch my bad videos that I shot on my phone.
Someone has to start somewhere, you know?
I mean,
in future years, like, you could be have
my
the whole
son
setup,
said, I want to have a YouTube channel, and I'm weird about my kids. Like, and I said, well, it's fine, but like, no one can know that, you know, you're my son. He was like, why would I tell anyone that?
That's the last thing you want.
I was like, he's like, it's for like video games. Why would I tell anyone I'm your son? Like, that doesn't get me any street cred. Right. I was like, you can never be cool to your own kids.
Right. Okay. Thank you, everyone, for joining us.